Match Volume. We're your hosts, Sadie Olson.
And Hala Oscar.
Hala, what are you obsessed with this week?
Recently, I invested in reusable sandwich and snack bags. So as opposed to using plastic bags that you easily throw away, these ones are, I guess, also made of plastic, but they are microwave safe, freezer safe, and most importantly, reusable.
Wow, a sustainability queen.
What about you, Sadie?
Well, I'm going to the mountains this week with my friends, and I realized that I didn't have a jacket here in toasty Los Angeles. So I went on Target's website and I bought a jacket for $30, which is incredibly cheap, and it is shockingly warm and really cute, actually. So that's really exciting.
Wow, what a steal. All right, let's dive into this week's topic. Sadie took the lead on this one, interviewing Kristen Gilger, author of There's No Crying in Newsrooms, and Audrey Yap, reporter for Variety.
This week, we're talking about what it's like to be a woman in media in today's world. We asked around to see if people think there are enough women in leadership roles. Let's hear what they have to say.
I think it's kind of looked down upon for women to be in like leadership roles, and that should change in the workforce and in school.
I feel as though there's a decreasing amount of obstacles in the way of people getting those roles, but I feel as though most roles aren't defined for a specific gender. It's just that the system in place has allowed men to get those roles instead of women.
I feel like most of the leadership positions, like all over the world, is more like men are dominating it.
I think that women have to prove themselves more than double of what men have to do. So that's why they don't get enough opportunities as men.
Okay, I'm sitting down with Kristen Gilger to talk about her new book, There's No Crying in Newsrooms, that she co-wrote with Julia Wallace. Kristen, thanks for coming to speak with me.
Thank you.
So let's talk about your book. How did you come up with this title?
So we had spent about a year and a half interviewing. We interviewed 116 people, I think it is, almost 100 of them women. And we'd been working about a year and a half. We had it ready to go. We were like 2 days away from it's going on the press. No title. And we had been through a zillion bad titles. And finally, I'm driving home one day and I thought, I love that movie, League of Their Own. I don't know if you've ever seen it. Tom Hanks, about women baseball players during World War II. And there's a scene in that movie where one of the women baseball players screws up. And Tom Hanks, who's a very reluctant coach of a women's team, starts yelling at her. And she starts crying. And he says, "Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying in baseball." And I love that scene, and I thought, that's it. And it made a lot of sense because a number of the women we interviewed actually talked about, you know, not being able to cry in the newsroom, you know, going to the ladies' room, or, you know, going to their car in the parking lot or something else, because tears are really not allowed.
Yeah. So the book explores the experience of being a woman in journalism. What was it like being a journalist when things weren't as equal as they are now?
Julie and I both entered newsrooms like, you know, around 1980. And there were women entering newsrooms in large numbers at that time. You know, it was sort of the post-Watergate, you know, post-Civil Rights Act signing, post-Vietnam War era, where a lot of women, for the first time in numbers, were entering newsrooms. So there were women, certainly not women in management roles, and women were still sort of shut out of certain sections, you know, business and opinion and sports in particular. But they were very macho places. You know, you had to, like, you know, learn how to, you know, drink, smoke, and cuss along with the guys if you were gonna make it. And these women who made their way to the top in those environments are just this amazing assortment of, you know, they're tough and they're funny and they have outrageous stories to tell. And nobody had really captured those stories. You know, women's history gets overlooked a lot. And there have been books about, you know, sort of the history going way back of women in journalism. Kay Mills has a great book. And there have been a lot of books that are sort of celebrity biography kind of books, you know, about people like Diane Sawyer or Christiana Amanpour. But nothing that sort of captured this period from about, you know, mid-1970s to present. And so we wanted to tell those stories.
You mentioned in the introduction that women appear to be slipping in journalism among other fields. Can you talk a bit about this trend?
Yeah, I mean, women were sort of at the height of being in top leadership roles at news organizations, and I'm talking about, you know, network television and, you know, public radio, newspapers, magazines, local television stations. They kind of were at the height in, like, early 2000s, late 1990s. And it's been slipping since. And there are fewer women in top leadership roles at news organizations now than there were 10 or 15 years ago. When you look at Fortune 500 companies, sort of the CEO level, it's improved some this year, but women are still like 6.6% of all CEOs of Fortune 500 companies. So there's some slippage, or certainly not improvement, in the rise into the leadership ranks.
At the beginning of your book, there's a brilliant foreword by Campbell Brown, and she tells a story about being a moderator at the Democratic debate in 2008 and having to pump milk in a closet minutes before going on air.
Yes.
Do you see this kind of perseverance emerging now, or has this been a theme among many of the women you've talked to?
I think a theme. I mean, and it sort of doesn't even matter age. You know, the women who came up in the 80s and 90s have these outrageous stories to tell. But young women entering newsrooms today, and they're really a big part of the reason we wanted to write the book. I mean, we teach students at the Cronkite School. We have daughters who are just getting their careers off the ground, and they kept telling us about their experiences, and we'd go, things haven't changed all that much, have they? And so our goals was to take these lessons from the women who have come before and distill those, tell their stories, and then distill lessons for young people coming into news organizations today. I think, you know, you tell me, but I think your generation thinks, oh, well, you know, a lot of the problems have been solved. Or what they tell us is they feel unprepared for what they're going to find in the workplace. And so we're really hoping this helps in some ways to help better prepare them.
Right. The list of women that you've interviewed for this book is extensive. Arianna Huffington, Jill Abramson, Rashida Jones. I'm pretty sure anyone could find one of their heroes on this list. And I think one of the most interesting parts in reading about your process was just how willing these women were to talk to you about their experiences. Do you think this process would have been harder if you had been talking to male journalists?
Oh, I don't know. I hadn't thought about that. Maybe not. What surprised us when we started, we just made a list of like every woman manager we would love to talk to. And we were really focusing on women behind the scenes generally. You know, there are a few people you would recognize, you know, Christiane Amanpour and Judy Woodruff and a few others. But we were primarily focusing on women who were behind the scenes running things. Mm-hmm. You know, they're the ones making the news decisions, making the hires, managing the newsroom. And so a lot of them, most people haven't heard of. So we made this list, and it was really long. And we thought, well, you know, maybe half, maybe a little more than that would be willing to talk to us. Because we were asking very personal questions. You know, we were asking them, so tell us about the obstacles you face. How did you fight your way up? You know, did you ever get sexually harassed? You know, how did you balance your family against this very demanding industry? You know, did you get divorced? Did your kids hate you? You know, I mean, you know, it very kind of personal questions. Yeah. So we thought, you know, not everybody's going to be wanting to go along with this. And what surprised us was that no one turned us down. And we spent days with some people and others very long phone conversations. And once you got people started talking, like, we couldn't get them to stop talking. And so I think that kind of illustrates, like, they were just waiting for somebody to ask them what their experiences had been.
one of my favorite stories was that of Aggie Underwood. Can you tell this story to our listeners and give your thoughts on her experience?
Yeah. I mean, like I said, we were focusing on a later period of time, right. But I couldn't resist telling about Aggie. So Aggie was, we think, the first female city editor of a major metropolitan newspaper. And she was the city editor at a now defunct paper in Los Angeles. And this is the 1940s, so it was very early for women to be in newsrooms. And Aggie kept, and we have a great picture of her in the book, kept a baseball bat on her desk and a gun loaded with blanks in her top desk drawer. And when things would get too quiet in the newsroom or, you know, the guys would get out of line, she'd take the gun out and fire blanks at the ceiling. And she said, you know, I had to do that to get their attention, you know, to get them to do what I wanted. So I thought it was a great story.
That is a great story. I love it. The Me Too movement has exposed some of the most trusted journalists as not who we thought they were. How do you see this movement continuing to change the face of journalism?
We actually started the book before the Me Too movement, so our timing was good, actually.
Yeah.
But I think even we were surprised at the extent of the problems in media organizations. Almost every media organization you can name has come afoul of this in some way or another. But I'm actually really encouraged by the movement because I think that young people are much more likely to speak up, to report behavior, to, you know, not put up with it. In my generation and earlier generations of women, I mean, we just sort of put up with it. You know, we thought we had to deal with it on an individual basis. You know, it was sort of just expected part of the job.
Right.
And I think it's great that women today are speaking up, and I certainly hope it brings about changes. Certainly, it's brought about awareness.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, there are some things we need to work on. You know, I keep reading about, you know, men feeling like, oh, well, I can't, like, go on a trip with a woman. I can't be in a meeting alone with a woman, you know. And that's just silly.
Yeah.
But I do think that we need to include men in this conversation and make men comfortable talking about mm-hmm. it and what's okay and what's not okay. And, you know, sometimes behavior is just, you know, sort of ignorance. It's not necessarily predatory behavior. And so, and I think men, especially young men, are very on board with trying to make things more inclusive. I think often they just don't know what to do, or is that okay or is that not okay? Mm-hmm. And that requires conversation. It requires trust and dialogue to make that happen. And I think that's on us as women to include men in the conversation.
I think as a young woman emerging in the field of journalism, I feel this sort of duality of like either I'm too bossy or I'm not doing enough. And your book really delves into that subject. How do you think that your writing will impact this feeling that many women have?
You know, I don't know. I think there is usefulness, utility, consolation in just knowing that you're not alone, mm-hmm. that many women feel this way. And almost everybody we interviewed said that they feel sort of constrained in their style, right? That if they're too tough, they're a bitch. You know, if they're too wimpy, they're a pushover.
Mm-hmm.
And that they have it, and they are therefore limited in some ways in the kind of leadership style that they develop. At the same time, they want to be authentic about who they are because, you know, you can't pretend mm-hmm. All the time. And so almost every woman we talked about this conundrum of trying to find mm-hmm. a spot that works both for them, feeling like, okay, this is who I am as a leader, but also works in a news organization. And this is true in any workplace. It doesn't matter if it's a news organization or not. So I think that women just need to be very intentional about understanding, okay, here's the situation. Here are some options that I have. I was reading an article that said one solution is to be tough on the outcome, tough mm-hmm. on the performance, and soft on the people. And I said, okay, I got to think that through. Maybe that could work. But there are differences. And so in the book, we sort of you know, describe different styles. Christiane Amanpour, she doesn't care if people call her a bitch. You know, she's way out there. And then we have others who are all along that continuum to Marcy McGinnis, who was the highest ranking woman at CBS for a long time. And, you know, she sort of got her way by sweet talking people. And there's a whole range of things. So you can kind of look at, okay, here are the options. Here's mm-hmm. where I feel good.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just knowing that other women have struggled with the same thing is helpful.
I'm here with Audrey Yap, journalist for Variety. So you cover a lot of different topics from sports, food, media, news. Is it challenging to cover that many things? And what is your favorite thing to talk about?
So I really started out in entertainment. And after being a producer in entertainment news, I was like, I'm not going to continue this. Like, I do not want to be, I was really stuck on myself. And I really thought I was like, I don't want to chase down celebrities on the red carpet, whatever. Cut to like years later, I've probably done like hundreds of red carpets, yeah. And it's super fun. But I think also pivoting and going to grad school was a really good way for me to also show that I'm not just interested in entertainment, that I'm not just a red carpet reporter, and that I could really go after stories I'm truly interested in. Sports, food, culture, social justice, education. These are things that I think more than ever are very important to cover, and you need a diverse journalism staff, you need a diverse newsroom staff who are able and willing and ready to cover it and offer a different voice.
So one of the articles I read from you was the one about Crazy Rich Asians. Do you want to talk a bit about that experience writing about that movie and how being Asian American in your field of work has affected your career?
So when I wrote that column about just how moving it was to see this very, very specific story portrayed on screen, it was really coming from a place of not having seen that before. And I think you don't really get that until you see it for the first time. The first time I watched the movie, I was at a screen. It was an industry screening, and I was with a friend. And we were both Asian American, and we were both just, like, incredibly nervous because you're just scared that someone's going to get it wrong, because we've been starving for so long for some kind of representation, that when you have something as explosive and transformative as a movie like Crazy Rich Asians, the hope is that you just get it right and that we're not the butt of the joke, even if we're the ones making up the joke. And it was a great first viewing, but I think both of us were just so on the edge of our seats that we could barely enjoy it the first time around. So I actually had to go back and watch it again with friends, and to be in like a bigger audience and just be like, oh yes, this is actually just a fun, enjoyable rom-com movie where, you know, people get to be people, and people who just happen to look like me get to be people and get to tell the jokes, but also get to be the heroes and get to be, you know, get to have their like happy ending. As far as me being Asian American and, you know, Southeast Asian American and a journalist in America, you know, it's really interesting, especially in entertainment. Even when I look back to when I was doing red carpets more regularly, I don't really remember seeing another, maybe more than one other Asian woman on the carpet, maybe two, you know, a handful here and there, or, you know, sometimes being a guest on shows, I would often be the only person of any ethnicity that wasn't white. Right. And all of a sudden, if you're put on a national spotlight, you feel that kind of weight of having to represent everyone. And I think anybody who is comes from a marginalized community, whether that's LGBT, whether that's a marginalized community, a religious community that's marginalized, you know, a woman, when you're the only one of that kind, when you're the only person checking that box, that pressure is unfair, and it's immense, and it's almost irritating, because I think at the end of the day, you just want to represent you. You don't want to represent all of Asian America. You don't want to represent, you know, every woman of color on the planet. And but that sometimes is the obligation that you are you have to fulfill when people come and tell you, hey, do you want to come on to this? And do you want to be a part of this? Or do you want to be a part of this show? You know, you end up being that voice. So, yeah.
Right. And you talked about like a comment from an executive where he said that he already had someone Asian working for him. So thanks, but no thanks. Like, we don't need you. So how does it feel to get comments like that?
It was bizarre to me that he would be this person, this executive would be so blatant about it and I'd be willing to like put it in writing. If anything, I saved it because just to remind myself that any place that I've been in, it's kind of been a transformative thing. It's almost been like my presence has almost been like a political thing in a way. It was, I would call ultimately just a very lazy thing to say, but unfortunately people like that exist and people like that are in positions of power. The nice thing is, I think in the past couple of years, as talk about what a newsroom looks like, who's covering what, who has the right to cover what, you know, who are the voices that are being included? Not just diverse, but included. I heard somewhere that like, there's a difference between diversity and inclusion. Diversity is something that you see, but inclusion is actually valuing whoever is in there. They are actually being included and their ideas are being taken seriously. So the nice thing that these topics are even coming up in recent years is, I think, a huge step forward. So emails like the one that I got become more of an artifact.
So the field of journalism hasn't always been welcoming to women. So what is your experience like being a woman in journalism?
It can be kind of an isolating experience. It can be, you have to bite your tongue a lot. And I think you really have to like pick your battles when there is that kind of boys locker room kind of talk, which I think most of it I kind of blocked out from memory now. But when that's happened, it doesn't feel great when they're, you know, objectifying a woman or talking about someone a certain way. But if you know, it just depends on like what position you're in. And I've definitely gone back and forth, and most of it you just kind of keep inside. It's not a great feeling. I think that being a woman and being a woman of color presents just incredibly unique challenges no matter what. I will also add that I've been very lucky to have some of my biggest champions and some of my biggest allies be ironically white men. And God bless them, because they still run a lot of stuff. And the fact that some of them have totally been my champion, like I could not progress in my career in the way that I have had they not been there for me, helping me, guiding me, you know, sharing resources with me. So it's not to paint anybody a certain way, but it is to say that there are also great allies for women.
How have you seen the Me Too movement affecting your workplace as a female journalist?
So I'll be very honest, when a lot of that erupted, I was freelance, which means I worked a lot from home and I was very much self-employed. But I will say, in terms of just watching the coverage and watching what kinds of stories were coming to light, what I observed and what I noticed is just women being heard, finally. And also women not being as afraid of coming forth with their stories. I still think there's a huge... anybody who has come forward with any kind of story of being assaulted or coerced or put in a position by a perpetrator in the workplace or otherwise, I mean, those women are incredibly brave. and these stories need to really be heard for women to be taken seriously in the workplace. And then that also spreads to everything else that comes with being a professional working woman, you know, getting paid fairly, getting treated fairly, not being punished if you want to start a family, not feeling like you were at a disadvantage for whatever reason, simply because you're a woman.
So I just interviewed this woman named Kristen Gilger, and she wrote a book called No Crying in Newsrooms. And one of the big things, and like something that I really relate to, is like that duality of like being seen as too bossy or being seen as like a pushover. So can you talk a little bit about how you found that balance as a working journalist and how that's affected you?
I think I'm still trying to find the balance of being perceived in a certain way. But let's get it clear. A guy does not think about that. A man in the workplace does not worry about whether he is coming off bitchy or petty or should I not have said that? Was that rude? Was that flippant? Was that this, that, the other thing? This is a burden that's uniquely placed on women. I would like to, at the end of the day, and I think the conclusion I've reached is that at the end of the day, do I stand by what I've done as work? Do I feel like I have championed the people I want to champion and the stories that I want to champion? Can I stand in that and feel good about myself? Can I rest my head and feel like I did the best that I could? Because if I want to pick the battles, they're there for me to pick. There's plenty. I'm an Asian American woman over 30. Like, there's a lot of, not as many as some, but there are battles that just being in a workspace, like, can be a minefield. And sometimes I think the best course of action is to just focus on the work and focus on staying grounded and staying true to your values. And if you have to cry, just get into that stall and just rip. Like, just let it go. I mean, we've all done it. It's fine. Like, you know, that is not weakness. That's being invested in your job. That's caring about your job. That's wanting to do better. At least that's the any time that I've cried. and it's rare. But anytime I have had, like, you know, everyone has their moments, just let it happen, take a walk, and then just keep going. Because that's the only thing that you can do.
Thanks for tuning in to Match Volume. A special thanks to Eileen Chen for contributing this week. Follow us on Instagram at Match Volume.
Tune in every other Friday for new episodes.
For Annenberg Media, I'm Hala Oscar.
And I'm Sadie Olson. Thanks for listening.